The ground did not arrive gently. It rose through violence, cracked by pressure, shoved upward from darkness where heat never rests. Long before names, long before sails or songs, the Caribbean existed as a fault line that refused to stay quiet. Fire pushed through seawater. Stone split, sank, then rose again. Nothing here was stable. Everything was earned. These islands were not shaped for comfort. They were shaped by collision, plates grinding, magma forcing decisions, earthquakes resetting the map without warning. What survived did so by chance and repetition, not mercy. Over millions of years, land learned how to stay above water. Rock cooled, edges hardened, new forms replaced what collapsed. This story begins before memory, before culture, before people believed land was permanent. It begins when the ground itself was the problem. To understand the Caribbean, one must first understand the pressure beneath it. The storms came later. The people came later. The stone came first. Chapter 1. Fire Underwater. The Caribbean did not begin as islands. It began as pressure with nowhere to go. Beneath what is now the Caribbean Sea, slabs of the Earth's crust collided in slow motion. This was not a single event. It was a long grind measured in millions of years, invisible to anything that breathes. The Caribbean plate pushed and scraped against larger plates on every side. None of them yielded easily. Heat built, rock weakened, something had to break. When it did, it broke underwater. Magma rose through fractures in the ocean floor, driven by heat and compression. Each surge was violent but brief. Lava met seawater and shattered. Steam exploded outward. Rock cooled too fast to become smooth. It cracked, stacked, and collapsed. What formed was unstable land, born in pieces, destroyed as often as it appeared. The earliest Caribbean terrain never stayed still long enough to be trusted. This was subduction at work. One plate forced beneath another, dragging minerals and water into the mantle. That water lowered the melting point of rock below. Magma followed the weakest path upward. Over time, lines of volcanoes formed arcs. These arcs were not random. They marked the edges of invisible boundaries where plates fought for position. Each eruption added material. Each collapse erased some of it. Islands rose, sank, then rose again. Some never stayed above sea level long enough to harden. Others accumulated layer after layer of volcanic rock, slowly building mass. Nothing here was flat. Nothing here was calm. The land grew steep because it had no choice. Earthquakes were constant. The ground shifted as pressure released in short, sharp bursts. Faults tore through, forming islands, splitting ridges and dropping valleys. Entire slopes slid into the sea. Shorelines changed without warning. What looked solid could fail overnight. Stability was temporary. Time is the key to understanding this violence. Not decades, not centuries. Tens of millions of years. The Caribbean basin developed as plates rearranged themselves, opening space in some areas and crushing it shut in others. New crust formed in places. Old crust was consumed in others. The region became a moving puzzle with pieces that refused to lock. Volcanoes dominated this phase. They were not picturesque peaks. They were vents. They bled rock and gas. Ash darkened the sky above the water. Lava flows buried older layers, sealing fractures while creating new ones. Some volcanoes built tall cones. Others spread wide shields. Many collapsed under their own weight, triggering landslides that raced into the sea and displaced water in deadly waves. These eruptions did more than build land. They defined its character. Volcanic rock is dense and heavy. It weathers slowly at first, resisting erosion until fractures allow water in. Early Caribbean islands were jagged, sharp-edged, and hostile. Rain ran off quickly. There was no soil to hold it. Fresh water was rare. Life struggled to take hold. Still, the islands persisted. As magma cooled, it crystallized into basalt and andesite. Layers stacked like pages in a book written by pressure. Each layer recorded an eruption, an earthquake, a collapse. Together, they formed the cores of islands that would later be reshaped, but never erased. Even today, those cores remain beneath forests and towns, holding memory in stone. The movement never stopped. The Caribbean plate continued to drift eastward, squeezed between the North and South American plates. Along its edges, stress accumulated. When released, it fractured land already weakened by volcanic construction. This kept islands narrow and mountainous. Wide plains could not form. Slopes dominated. Gravity ruled. Underwater, the same forces carved trenches and ridges. Deep basins formed where crust stretched and thinned. Elevated seafloor marked old volcanic chains now drowned by subsidence. What remained above water was only part of the story. Most of the Caribbean's structure lies hidden, mapped only by sound and inference. This phase set the limits of everything that followed. Island size, shape, elevation, the presence of mountains close to the sea. These were not accidents. They were consequences of how the land was born. A gentle process would have produced different outcomes. The Caribbean did not have that luxury. Heat gradually declined in some zones. Volcanic activity slowed. Eruptions became less frequent. Rock had time to cool fully. Fractures sealed. The islands stopped changing shape every few thousand years and began to hold their form. Not because pressure disappeared, but because balance, for the moment, was reached. But even in quiet periods, danger remained close. Dormant volcanoes sat beneath rain and vegetation, waiting. Fault lines cut through valleys and offshore shelves. The ground could still move without warning. Stability here was always conditional. By the end of this chapter, in the Caribbean's deep past, land existed that could endure. Not comfortable land, not welcoming land, but land that stayed above water long enough to matter. Volcanic arcs stood in lines that would later guide ocean currents and storms. Mountain spines rose high enough to catch clouds. The raw framework of the region was in place. What had been created was not a finished product. It was a foundation, rough, uneven, still dangerous, but real. The Caribbean did not begin as a home. It began as a test. Chapter 2. Stone that learns to breathe. When the fire slowed, the water took over. The volcanic islands that survived their own birth faced a new threat that worked more slowly but just as relentlessly. Rain fell, waves struck, wind pressed salt into every fracture. What fire had lifted, water began to grind down. This was not destruction for its own sake. It was a second phase of shaping, one that determined whether land could endure or vanish. Volcanic rock is hard, but it is not immune. Rain seeped into cracks left by cooling lava. Temperature changes widened those cracks. Over time, entire slopes weakened. Rock broke loose grain by grain, then block by block. Rivers formed not because the land invited them, but because gravity forced water to find a path downhill. Those rivers carried stone back to the sea. Along the coast, waves never stopped working. Each impact removed a little more material. Cliffs retreated, headlands collapsed, beaches appeared where debris settled. The outline of each island began to soften. Sharp edges became slopes, slopes became shelves. This erosion did not flatten the land, but it prepared it for the next builders. Those builders were alive. Coral organisms arrived in shallow, sunlit water near the edges of volcanic islands. They did not care about fire or fault lines. They cared about light, temperature, and stability. Where conditions were right, they anchored themselves to submerged rock and began to grow. Slowly, patiently, millimeter by millimeter. As coral colonies expanded, they created limestone frameworks that absorbed wave energy. Reefs formed barriers offshore, breaking the force of incoming surf. Behind those barriers, calmer water allowed sediment to settle instead of being swept away. Sand accumulated. Lagoons took shape. The relationship between land and sea began to change. This was not a single event. It happened repeatedly as sea levels rose and fell. When sea level dropped, coral reefs were exposed and died. When it rose again, new reefs formed higher up the slope. Over time, these cycles created thick layers of limestone stacked atop volcanic foundations. In some places, the original volcanic core sank while coral kept growing upward, maintaining its position near the surface. Entire islands emerged this way. Low flat land composed almost entirely of coral limestone rose where no volcano stood above water anymore. These islands lacked mountains. They lacked rivers. But they stayed above sea level because life built them faster than erosion could tear them down. Storms tested this balance constantly. Hurricanes pushed waves over reefs and into lagoons, redistributing sand and breaking coral. Coastlines shifted overnight. Inlets opened and closed. What survived did so because the underlying structure absorbed shock instead of shattering. Coral and limestone, though fragile in pieces, proved resilient in mass. Fresh water became the next challenge. Volcanic islands with steep slopes shed rain quickly. Coral islands, made of porous limestone, absorbed it instead. Rainwater filtered downward, forming freshwater lenses that floated above denser seawater underground. These lenses were fragile. Overuse or contamination could collapse them. but where they persisted, they made permanent occupation possible. Soil developed slowly. On volcanic islands, erosion turned ash and rock into mineral-rich ground. On coral islands, soil formed from organic matter trapped by vegetation. Neither process was fast. Both required stability. Plants that could tolerate salt spray and poor nutrients arrived first. Their roots held sediment in place. Their decay added organic material. Each generation made the land slightly more forgiving. The islands learned to breathe in this phase, not literally, but functionally. Water moved through them instead of tearing them apart. Energy dissipated across reefs and shelves. The violence of the earlier era did not disappear, but it was buffered. The land stopped being purely reactive and began to regulate itself. Sea level changes remained a constant pressure. During colder periods, water locked in ice lowered sea levels, exposing new land and extending coastlines. During warmer periods, rising seas drowned low areas and pushed shorelines inland. Coral growth tracked these changes imperfectly. Where it kept up, islands survived. Where it lagged, they disappeared beneath the water. This is why the Caribbean contains both high volcanic islands and low limestone platforms within short distances. Each represents a different balance point between construction and erosion, between biological growth and geological force. No two islands followed exactly the same path, but all were shaped by the same rules. By the end of this phase, the Caribbean was no longer just raw rock. It was a system. Landforms interacted with ocean currents. Reefs altered wave patterns. Sediment moved in predictable ways. The islands had identities defined by their composition and elevation. Crucially, this was when permanence became possible. Not guaranteed, but possible. Land existed that could support vegetation long term. Fresh water could persist through dry seasons. Shorelines could remain stable for generations instead of centuries. The ground was no longer changing faster than life could adapt. But this stability came with limits. Coral islands were vulnerable to storms and sea level rise. Volcanic islands remained prone to landslides and earthquakes. The land could support life, but it demanded respect. It offered opportunity, but only within boundaries set by its formation. Nothing about this stage was gentle. It was slower than fire, quieter than earthquakes, but relentless. Water never stopped moving, coral never rushed, erosion never rested. Together, they transformed chaos into structure. By the time this chapter closes, the Caribbean had become a place that could be lived on. Not because it was safe, but because it had stopped erasing itself entirely. The stone had learned how to stay. The next question was not whether land existed, but how that land would decide what kind of life could remain. Chapter 3, Land That Decides How People Live. By the time people arrived, the land had already made its decisions. The Caribbean did not wait for human intention. Its mountains, coasts, and water systems were set by forces that operated without regard for settlement, trade, or survival. What humans encountered was not raw possibility, but a finished framework with strict limits. Every choice that followed was shaped by what the ground allowed. On volcanic islands, elevation defined life. Mountain spines rose sharply from the sea, forcing rain upward. Clouds broke against ridges and released water unevenly. Windward slopes received steady rainfall. Leeward sides remained dry. This created sharp contrasts over short distances. Valleys could be fertile while nearby hills stayed bare. Rivers formed where slopes and rainfall aligned. Elsewhere, water vanished underground or ran off too fast to be stored. Soil followed the same logic. Where volcanic ash accumulated and weathered, it produced deep, mineral-rich ground. These areas could support dense vegetation and later sustained agriculture. Where erosion stripped slopes bare, rock remained close to the surface. Farming there required constant effort. Terraces, retention walls, and careful water management became necessities, not innovations. On limestone islands, the rules were harsher. Flat terrain offered ease of movement, but little fresh water. Rain disappeared into porous rock, leaving no rivers to follow inland. Settlements clustered near reliable freshwater lenses or seasonal catchments. Population size was limited not by land area, but by water security. Overuse carried consequences that arrived slowly but decisively. Coastlines dictated access. Deep bays and sheltered inlets created natural harbors. Narrow shelves and steep drop-offs limited safe anchorage. Islands with multiple protected coves invited movement and exchange. Those without them remained isolated unless technology bridged the gap. Trade routes did not emerge randomly. They followed coastlines shaped by erosion and reef growth. Fishing zones formed where reefs and shelves supported marine life. Communities near these areas gained protein without clearing land. Where reefs were absent or damaged, reliance shifted inland, increasing pressure on limited soil and water. Even diet followed geological boundaries. Natural barriers mattered. Mountain ranges divided islands internally, creating cultural separation over short distances. Steep terrain slowed movement and communication. Valleys developed local identities because crossing ridges was costly and dangerous. On low islands, openness brought different risks. Storm surge and flooding threatened everything at once. There was no high ground to retreat to. Survival depended on prediction and preparation rather than shelter. Geology also decided vulnerability. Volcanic islands carried the constant possibility of eruption and earthquake. Even dormant systems imposed risk. Settlements avoided unstable slopes and fault lines when possible, but necessity often overrode caution. Landslides erased villages without warning. Earthquakes rearranged coastlines and water sources. Memory of these events shaped building practices and settlement placement. On limestone islands, the danger came from absence rather than violence. Drought could empty freshwater lenses. Salt intrusion could poison wells. Storms could overwrite the entire landscape in a single night. Rebuilding was expected. Permanence was not. These constraints did not stop human culture from forming. They shaped it. Architecture adapted to terrain and materials. Wood dominated where forests thrived. Stone appeared where rock lay close to the surface. Roof pitch followed rainfall patterns. Settlement density reflected water availability. These were practical responses, not aesthetic choices. Movement between islands followed predictable paths. Currents, winds, and distances were all influenced by island placement and elevation. Chains of islands created stepping stones across open water. Gaps created barriers that limited contact. Over time, these patterns reinforced differences in language, practice, and exchange. The land also decided what could not be sustained. Large centralized populations struggled where resources were fragmented. Extensive agriculture failed where soil thinned quickly. Infrastructure remained small scale because the ground resisted heavy alteration. Attempts to force the land into unfamiliar roles carried costs that accumulated over generations. What appears today as cultural diversity is inseparable from this physical groundwork. The Caribbean is not a single environment. It is a mosaic created by geological variation compressed into a small region. Each island represents a different solution to the same problem, how to live within limits that cannot be negotiated. It is tempting to credit human ingenuity alone for survival here. That ignores the prior work of stone and water. The islands that endured long enough to be settled had already filtered what was possible. People adapted, but they did not choose the terms. Even now, those terms persist. Mountain runoff still dictates flooding. Limestone still controls water storage. Reefs still buffer storms where they remain intact. Where those systems fail, the consequences arrive quickly. The ground does not forget its origins. The Caribbean's history is often told through movement, conflict, and exchange. Beneath that narrative lies a quieter truth. The shape of the land decided where people could stay, where they could travel, and how much they could extract without collapse. Culture followed contours laid down millions of years earlier. This is not determinism. Human choice mattered, but choice operated within a frame that could not be altered without consequence. The islands rewarded attention and punished neglect. They offered abundance in specific places and scarcity everywhere else. By understanding the geological forces that built the Caribbean, the region stops being abstract. It becomes legible. The storms, the settlements, the limits all trace back to how the land rose, stabilized, and endured. Stone came first. Everything else learned to live on top of it. The ground did not shape culture alone, but it set the boundaries. And within those boundaries, the Caribbean became what it is.